This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us William Powers, who's speaking with us from Bolivia. He is a senior fellow at the New York City-based think tank World Policy Institute, where he focuses on international development, environmental policy, and sustainable consumption, and currently leads the Living Well Collaborative Project based in Bolivia. He teaches on the adjunct faculty at New York University and has won awards for many books and articles about diverse subjects about sustainable living. He has been a keynote speaker, lecturer, or panelist at over 100 events in the United States and abroad. Powers has worked as a fellow at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., head of programs for Catholic Relief Services in Liberia, and chief of party of the USAID Conservation International Rainforest Conservation Program, again in Bolivia. He holds international affairs degrees from Brown University and Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. Dispatches from the Sweet Life, One Family, 5 Acres, and A Community's Quest to Reinvent the World is his newest book, and the one we'll be talking about today. You can learn more about Bill at www.williampowersbooks.com. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thanks so much, Sheila.
I'm so excited to be able to talk to you from the distance that we are apart and to talk about your experience that you write about so sweetly in the book, Dispatches from the Sweet Life. So I thought maybe a good way to start our conversation would be to have you read from your preface that kind of gets the reader's feet in your story.
Okay. Well, yeah, from the preface, you know, I say that there's no single definition of the South American idea of vivir bien, or living well. The Quechuas call it sumacuasi, the Amaras sumacamaña. It also draws from the Guarani idea of harmonious living. Some, like Bolivian philosopher Javier Medina, call this alternative culture la vida dulce, or the sweet life, happiness achieved through human community in balance with nature. So from the moment I first arrived in Bolivia in 2001, I was fascinated by this new and ancient Bolivian dream. Fleshed into the larger society, the sweet life worldview seemed the opposite of my own culture's American dream, which positions the individual via competition atop a set of natural resources for exploitation.
And you found something quite different in Bolivia than you found in New York City.
Right. So with that idea, I certainly found something quite a bit different here, which is why we moved down from the city.
As you're reading the quote that you read from the preface, I'm thinking about where we live up here on the Olympic Peninsula and how hard people are working towards something more community-based, something more collaborative in farming, selling produce, almost every kind of activity that a community would want to give. And yet it's not infused with the South American culture like you found there. So do you happen to have an excerpt from your book that kind of shows how you had to learn a different process for being community because you were in Bolivia as opposed to New York?
Well, yeah, there's this concept here that people are only people through other people, as opposed to a more individualistic idea where it's every person for themselves trying to achieve something. One of the conflicts that we came into right away was this idea of having a transition town, which I'm sure some of you in Washington have heard of transition towns. In some ways, that was a Western export. Like, it's something that was born in Totnes, England, and has gone to 1,600 towns around the world. And towns that are looking for a lighter carbon footprint, more alternative agriculture, local economy, and quite frankly, more happiness achieved through community. But when we became Bolivia's first transition town in 2015, there was a sense that, well, wait a minute, now this is another kind of like almost colonial exercise of a sort of something from the outside being imposed. So there was a pushback, almost like an anarchic kind of a pushback against any kind of like rubric that goes against the vernacular culture, which is like the kind of culture that's developed over generations in harmony with a certain biosphere and is therefore very resilient.
Do you have a portion of the book that you could read that kind of folds that in?
Sure. Yeah, I just wanted to give that as a little preface. And I do actually have one for you today.
Oh, good.
This is a moment when I was back in the United States after, say, our first year of this big move down to Bolivia. And I was back in the country for a book tour and from giving some speeches in California. And this moment that I'm going to read to you kind of brought me back to something very important that I learned in Bolivia. So I'll just start here from Dispatches from the Sweet Life. In San Francisco, after a book talk and two interviews, I'm feeling strained and exhausted. Regardless, I'm in front of a laptop at my hotel about to pull a late-nighter to prepare for another talk the next evening. Then I remember Karina's words from under her grape trellises in faraway Bolivia. "What's finished," she said, "is done." I stand up and look out my hotel window. A billboard for Home Depot reminds me to never stop improving. A truth dawns. Never stop improving is not just one corporation's slogan. It's America's. As much as I might cringe to confess it, it's mine too. It's the voice that says, you're not quite good enough. You can always be better. Years ago in Liberia, I heard a story about a pair of African porters hired by a Belgian trader to help him prospect gold deep in the forest. After 2 days of brisk walking, the porters sat down and refused to budge. The trader tried several things to inspire them to keep going: belligerent demands, flattery, an increase in salary. No matter what the man tried, the porters refused to move. They told him they'd been walking too fast and had to wait for their souls to catch up. I have a choice. Am I a prospector or porter? I can work hard on the speech and shine in tomorrow's podium, and then sweat and shine at laptops and podiums for all my tomorrows, preaching a slow life gospel I don't happen to practice. I can let the dream guide my efforts to critique the dream, to make a career out of my supposed anti-career yet again. Or I can embody the shift. I can stop improving. Allow what's finished to be done. Be satisfied exactly with what is right now. I stash the computer and head out into the city night. That air smells like eucalyptus and brackish water. I hoof it all the way to Golden Gate Park, where I bushwhack off the main path to the base of a Monterey cypress tree. I will improvise tomorrow's speech. Right now, I need to sit in the light of a waning moon and wait for my soul to catch up.
Beautiful. Thank you. It really does speak to the intersection between having been raised in North America, U.S., mm-hmm. and living and learning from a South American culture. So how did that talk go?
Well, maybe not as well as it would have gone with lots of preparation, but I find that just having the passion and the energy and enthusiasm goes sometimes a lot longer than this kind of right-brained tendency we have in the West to get everything perfect.
Mm-hmm. But I have a feeling it probably went better than you are thinking it did now, because that's part of the I can always improve part, is to always think of what didn't work out as expected, as opposed to, as I know in your book, you find lots of unexpected moments and reflect on them and help the reader participate in them and see how wonderful life is when you're open like that and don't have this set agenda all the time. And yet you have an agenda of building a home and becoming part of the community. So I think the duality of how we exist is well represented in your book and speaks very well to people who live in a Western culture, who North American culture, who live their lives with agendas. And it's always something to negotiate, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's kind of a fun process of what we call in Latin America, like you walk questioning, caminar preguntando. Like every step you take is another question.
That's a beautiful line.
Right. Like life without sort of paradigms that are very specific. We use the word anarchic, but there's other terms that you can kind of use for it. But the basic idea is a lack of analytical structure to your life, so that you're living more of a biocentric or ecocentric connection to the world around you. Mm-hmm. And then you have intuition and your heart guiding you more than your mind.
I love the image of resting so that your soul can catch up with you. I think it's something we have a hard time doing here because we don't live in a moment. We live in the next moment that's coming, and we get ahead of ourselves in so many ways. I think that's really wise, and I'm really glad to have learned it this morning. You use the words in your book about your goal with having moved to Bolivia and your work around the world. You say, revillage, repurpose, and restore. And they're really fun to say together. And what is that about, revillaging, repurposing, restoring?
Some of those terms are from the transition movement and the revillaging idea. You know, revillaging is the counter trends to urbanization, where people are moving back to smaller places, where you have more community, often a lower cost of living, more contact with nature, and more walkability. Restoration, repurposing, that's about, you know, here, for example, in our town, things are constantly being recycled, but not just recycled. Yes, we have a recycling program, that's true, but oftentimes it's like the old bottles are turned into flower pots, or, you know, shoes are reworked with a new sole. Like, constantly things are being restored. Another part of the restoration is embracing Pachamama, which is the word here for Mother Earth. And so that, for us, has become kind of a natural thing. Like, just by living here for the past 5 years, we plant under the waning full moon, always, you know, for our gardens. We always offer a bit of drink to Pachamama, pour a little bit of whatever you're about to drink into the ground before toasting another human being. First, you give some to Mother Earth. It's just, everyone does this. We just did a chaya 2 weeks ago for our house. That we're building a new house, adobe bioconstruction house here. And it's offering singani, this local beverage, to the four corners of the house. Women's full moon gatherings. All of this is just such a common texture. It's hard to sort of describe it, but it becomes so natural, like for our children, for example, that they just take all of this for granted, which I think is a beautiful thing.
Yes, and in the book, you quote your older daughter and tell us about your younger daughter, who at the time isn't very old at all, and how they're just at home in the culture and say these most beautiful and wise things that come right up out of their relationship to the earth, but also to the community, and also to their parents who are part of the earth and the community. So it's a very restorative read, your book Dispatches from the Sweet Life. And I think that this book is different than your previous books. It's more memoir, although it's full of information. How was that for you, writing something that diverges from what you had been writing?
I love memoir. I think it's a beautiful intersection between journalism and current events and history, you know, all of the sort of social scientific nonfiction world, and then fiction, right? So I think there's like a millimeter of distance between fiction and nonfiction. Like, because even when you're writing in a purely journalistic mode, it's like where you put the lens of that camera, that so-called camera, you've already eliminated like 99.9% of reality. So already you've lost all objectivity in a sense by your choice of focus and your style of writing and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a beautiful way to communicate complex ideas using stories.
Absolutely.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Sheila is talking with William Powers, Senior Fellow at the New York City-based think tank World Policy Institute, about his new book, Dispatches from the Sweet Life, One Family, 5 Acres, in a Community's Quest to Reinvent the World.
Did you feel as a writer that you could always improve? Did you worry about the performance of the book and you as a writer?
Well, you know, actually the two previous books in this trilogy, 12 by 12, which was about living in an off-grid 12 foot by 12 foot cabin. And then the second one, which was New Slow City, about living simply in fast city like Manhattan. Both of those were also in the memoir genre. Mm-hmm. So I'd already had quite a bit of kind of practice in how that works. I think really what it is I just love fiction. I read novels all the time. I just appreciate sort of character development and story arc and how you do dialogue and so forth. So it's kind of fun to do that.
So you found that working for you in Dispatches. It does tell a story of your journey to the point, of when you are writing the book. And it's not only a story of revillaging, repurposing, and restoring, but it's a love story. And I think it's partly a love story about how the love in families and human communities deepen as we deepen our love for forest plants, fauna, and our skies. And you have an analogy to trees, the way your book is structured, the arc goes along with anatomy of a tree. Can you discuss that?
Sure. I layered a kind of four-part structure that corresponds to the four components of the sweet life. So there's, like you said, each part of the tree. So the first is the search for balance. Second is the complementarity of diversity. The third, a unified vision. And the fourth is initiation, right? So these are the four aspects of sort of Andean Amazonian sweet life. So the search for balance is how you don't go to extremes. You're always looking for balance both in your internal equilibrium and then in your community and with others. Just a very common principle here. The other is the complementarity of diversity, which is that we look at our system in the U.S. now with all the tension around diversity and so forth. But here, in some ways, there's more of like, they see human diversity as more of like an ecosystem diversity, at least in the purer sense. So you look for more diversity. It gives more robustness to the system. The unified vision is La Pacha, as they call it here. La Pacha is that there's one unified field that we're part of. We're not separate. This anthropocentric way we have of like thinking that we're extracted from the web of life kind of disappears. And finally, initiation. That's the fourth part of the tree, like the sort of the sky above the tree. Initiation is leaving the human matrix and stepping into nature as our larger home.
With a respect for the unknown, I love your epigraph to the book by a chief called Chief Gaspar. And the epigraph reads, "A tree holds up the seven skies. We venerate all trees because we do not know which one holds up the world." I love the sense of mystery and participation in it. And I think your book definitely talks about how if we venerate Mother Earth, we are part of the whole, which includes mystery because we can't know it all. So I want you to, if you don't mind, repeat the name of the town that you live in. I don't know if people caught it.
Well, I call it Suraketa in the book because I was trying to lightly veil the identity of the town. But I can just tell you here, it's called Samaipata, which is a Quechua word that means resting in the highlands. Mm. And it's where the Andes meets the Amazon, eastern Bolivia.
And you speak about a lot of expats who live there from all over the world. And did they all find that town the way you did? Because it's one of the special towns in Bolivia that has an ecological focus?
Yeah, there's people in our town from 30 countries around the world, mostly European countries and Latin American. We're the only Americans here. There's some Canadians. And people were attracted to different things because it's kind of like a cosmopolitan village, similar to other transition towns like Brighton Bay in Australia or Totnes in England. Some people who come for the great climate, because 9 months out of the year, it's kind of like nice kind of spring weather, like right now. Or others, I'd say the majority have come for alternative lifestyles, that sense of leaving the kind of fast-track American dream kind of vision and coming into a slower, more purposeful lifestyle and community. And so there's a lot of organic farms. There's some spiritual centers, one called Eco Dao, another called Quinta Conciencia, where people are doing meditation and ayahuasca and other medicinal plants and so forth. There's cafes and restaurants and hotels. So I think a lot of the expats that have come here have started those types of businesses that appeal to a broader kind of international audience. But the overall percentage is only about 3% of our town, and the other 97% is Bolivian.
And do people all get along?
Well, I mean, as you know from reading the book, difficulties, it's like anywhere in the world, especially when you have xenophobia and walls going up in different places in the world. I mean, there's always a blowback. And at a certain point, we actually were taken into custody while we're having dinner in town, when they were rounding up all the foreigners and just checking documents and so forth. And it was my one time that I had the biggest empathy with others in the United States who are treated that way and taken into even worse when you don't have the kind of privilege we have. Several Germans were deported for not having the correct papers and so forth. So yeah, there's that tension.
So, and were those local? You were taken into local custody by local officials?
Well, no, it was the Interpol, the police from Santa Cruz that came, Bolivian police from Santa Cruz who came in and did kind of a sting.
Yeah, so it's separate from really from your community. So it is like everywhere in the world, and it has its sad aspects, which is not to say that it still isn't the sweet life, right? Because the sweet life, as you describe it, doesn't say there isn't struggle, but it's a different way of struggling.
Right. It's all more like sweet lives. Anyone listening there in the Pacific Northwest can sort of ask, like, what's my sweet life? How do I find more connection to nature, to the ancestors, to community, to things beyond this sort of programmed American dream, which is just so ubiquitous, as all of us know, living in the country. You know, it's just, you don't necessarily have to travel and leave the country like we did to find that. I mean, you can find it anywhere, but it's just, it's a question of kind of like waking up and saying, wait a minute, I don't need to be in this media narrative of scarcity and conflict and the next school shooting and the next this. You can kind of, in a sense, step out of that and have it be just like the background noise of your life, mm-hmm. and then find in the foreground the song of the world, as the French novelist Gino calls it, which is this vast song of the rest of nature thrumming and gushing around us.
I think we try hard up here, huge numbers of us really, and we have something resembling a gift economy that you describe. Quite never know where the gifts are coming from. I love that part of the surprises of people in the community having things to offer and then you finding what you have to offer. And that's part of what you're talking about, I'm sure, is that to come out of the dream and wake up means to see people around you and participate.
Absolutely. Yeah, the gift economy is a beautiful thing. Anything that's out of the cash economy, you know, whether it's we do swaps here like and really free markets like they do in the United States, in New York and other places, but also just the textured culture here that involves somebody will come and work for a half day in your orchard in exchange for lending them your bicycle or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, those types of exchanges are common.
So what people feel is of value to them is what they take in exchange. I mean, many of us would think, wow, working in your orchard is hard work and riding a bicycle, loaning a bicycle is easy. But that's not the equation.
Right. And sometimes it is unequal. But then you have a kind of a reciprocity going where you actually owe somebody something.
Mm-hmm. Your book is a gift because it awakens, in so many of its readers, an idea of how to look at the world differently and how to sink in when things are foreign to you and learn. So I'm wondering if you could describe your hopes for the book as it's out in the world.
If it's hard to say. Some people will read it as kind of like a fun novel and just a really interesting vicarious experience of what it's like to leave the U.S. and move abroad and what Bolivia is like and so forth. But there's a meta narrative which is about walking questioning and actually loving questioning, doing everything questioning.
Mm-hmm.
So one definition of the sweet life, which I heard recently, was living well, is what they call it here, VVBN. So living well. What's living well? It's eating well, sleeping well, loving well. There's kind of a simplicity to that that cuts beautifully through everything, all the things that we worry about. This was a Bolivian indigenous person who just defined it that way. Imagine we could become a creature among creatures and simplify our lives more and really see that as the good life or the sweet life, is eating well, sleeping well, loving well.
I like that. You boil it down to three things. So as we make resolutions about our lives, it's easier to do it if we're looking at those three basic things. Is there anything else you want to tell us before our time is over?
Well, I think we covered a lot, and I hope that if you get a chance to pick up the book that you enjoy it, and you're welcome to get in touch with me. We have a website, williampowersbooks.com, with an email address to get in touch. I often have student groups coming through, and we do a lot of kind of exchanges, especially where there's people from the Global South, from our town, kind of sharing their practices and ways of life with mostly American students that come through.
When you say students, are you talking about your NYU students, or can other people contact you about becoming part of a group?
Absolutely. I mean, I do bring down my NYU students. It's a master's course on sustainable development. And then there's U.S. Exchange students through the Bolivia program of SIT. But also others come through and volunteer on the different organic farms or do activities here. Sometimes we help people out, just placing them somewhere.
It sounds very exciting and nice. And is there a particular season that's more fun than others?
all the seasons are good, but the winter here, which is June, July, August, you have to have the chimney going. It gets kind of cold.
And do you still do farming during that time?
Yes, we do, because it's a year-round growing season. So right now I'm looking out from my writing studio out into the orchard, and actually we have 40 types of fruit trees that range from tropical, like there's bananas and guayabas and so forth, all the way to like mandarins, apples, pears, and so forth. So that goes year-round. I have it set up so there's something every month, basically, coming out of the orchard. Like right now we're harvesting grapes, and we just finished peaches and apples. And so, yeah, you have year-round, and that's awesome, too, because you're never without fresh produce.
And that's, according to the book, you reforested and planted all those trees.
Yes, we planted this whole orchard, all like maybe it's 100 total fruit trees of like 30 or 40 varieties, and about 300 forest trees that we've planted all throughout our property in a reforestation effort. And also the process of uncovering the native trees, like I talked about that, how sometimes you ignore that aspect, but there's the tulas and the carnivals and the tipas, the different trees, and we just cleared out the thorny bushes over a process of a year. And now those are becoming large trees, too.
So these large trees are how old? Well, not the ones that are becoming large because they're not suffocating, but the ones you planted that are bearing fruit now, how old are they?
They're about 4 years old now.
And they're doing well?
Yes, they're doing great.
And they're happy to be part of the sweet life. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I want to repeat your website so people can find out more, especially how to read your books, where to get your books, what they are, and how to visit you in one of these projects. The website is www.williampowersbooks.com, and perhaps we'll talk again soon.
I hope so, and thanks so much for having me on your program.
Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.